You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Women have good reason to be wary of the pharmaceutical industry. We've been offered a series of inadequately tested drugs, from thalidomide 50 years ago to hormone replacement therapy now. In 1998, a handful of activists formed Women and Health Protection, a national network of academic researchers, medical practitioners, and consumers. Women and Health Protection have just published their first book. It's called The Push to Prescribe. The book took 10 years to produce and covers everything from the problems with Ottawa's drug regulations to the consequences of releasing pharmaceuticals into the environment. Barbara Mintzes is a member of Women and Health Protection, and she's with the Therapeutics Initiative at UBC. Barbara wrote a chapter on women and direct-to-consumer advertising, and she's joined me in the studio this morning. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
Now, your chapter's called Ask Your Doctor. What's behind that phrase?
It's a continue. If you've seen any of the advertisements on television, for instance, from the U.S., every ad will say, ask your doctor if this medicine is right for you. The reason, of course, is that there's something very different about prescription drugs compared with other consumer products that are advertised on television or in a magazine, in that they're somewhat controlled substances. In the, a person cannot actually go out and buy the product. They have to have it prescribed to them by a doctor because they're considered to be a serious medical treatment with, you know, that has to be used with care.
Now, in Canada, we have a little bit of a different situation than the United States in that the drug name isn't mentioned. Am I right?
Not exactly. In Canada, if you look at the Food and Drugs Act, prescription drug advertising to the public is illegal. Companies cannot either sell the drug directly to the public or advertise it directly to the public. Now, there was an amendment to that regulation that was brought in 1975 to allow companies to be able to advertise comparative prices to the public. And that was actually brought in as part of an effort to promote the use of generic drugs. The idea was that only the name, price, and quantity could be advertised, and pharmacists could post comparative prices in their windows. We've seen a shift in around the year 2000 with the federal government reinterpreting that provision in law to say that as a result, it was okay in Canada, it is okay in Canada to advertise the an ad with the name of the product.
But not the use
or vice versa, which is, you know, if you think, why would anybody bring, you know, why would they think of actually having a law that said something of the sort? The answer is they didn't. This was the federal government at the time was under very heavy pressure from the industry to change the law. They'd already held a couple of national consultations. There didn't seem to be interest from Parliament or the public in changing the law. And, you know, one way of interpreting this is it's a bit of a back table way, you know, an under the table way of bringing in a compromise solution that really has little to do with the public health objectives of the law in the first place.
Now, this kind of ask your doctor ad, you have some examples in your section of the book of this kind of ad, and you have one you have one from the Globe and Mail in 2004, I Am Julie.
Mm.
Can you describe that ad?
Okay, that's an ad that shows sort of a woman's body from about the waist to the knees, and she's wearing stockings and a garter belt, and it says, last night I did a striptease for my husband. What would you do with a few pounds less? Now, that ad is for a product called Xenical, which at the time was the only drug for obesity that was approved in Canada. It's illegal in a number of ways, in my opinion. Like, one of them is that it's a direct-to-consumer ad for a specific prescription drug. It was accompanied by letters and other advertising to doctors that told them this I Am Julie campaign was going on and that they could expect women patients to come in and to ask for a solution for obesity. The other thing is that, or to ask for a weight loss drug. The other thing is that this drug is not approved just to lose a few pounds. You can see from this woman's bum, she's not an obese woman, which is what the drug is. It's approved only for obesity, so body mass index over 30, or else very overweight women with heart disease as well. So we made a complaint. Actually, Women in Health Protection made a complaint about this advertising campaign to Health Canada when it was going on. There was also a TV ad with a woman who was not obese saying that she tried all these things to lose weight and then she went to her doctor and found a solution. There are a lot of, there's some ironies about that ad because one of the most prominent side effects for this drug is anal leakage or sort of, sort of a bit of diarrhea, which is quite liquid and hard to control. And, you know, then you have this prominent picture of a woman's bum. It's not the most pleasant sort of idea of a striptease.
Now, if the woman goes to the doctor with this ad in hand, do the pharmaceutical companies always ensure that the doctor knows what the ad will be and what that woman is coming and responding to?
They tend to advertise to use this kind of ad that doesn't have the brand name in it when they have a product that's the market leader in that category, or maybe they have the only product in that category. So she doesn't even have to have the ad in hand, in the sense that they, so there are a couple of things that are going on. The direct-to-consumer ads are just part of a larger marketing campaign. The doctor will have had visits probably from sales representatives, will have free samples on hand. And if women come in and ask for a drug to help them lose weight, and this is just about the only drug that's a prescription drug, the company can be sure that most of the people who come in, if they're prescribed something, would be prescribed this drug. The other thing I should mention about it is it's not a very effective drug, even in obesity. The difference is about 3 kilos in weight loss on average over a one-year period in the clinical trials, and many people voted for with their feet. They left, they left the trials early because in both the drug and placebo groups, things weren't working out very well for them.
Now, you say that many of the ads borrow feminist language. What kind of language do they use?
It's not so much the ads themselves that borrow feminist language as the way the advertising has been talked about. And it's been discussed as a source of empowerment, helping patients have more choice about their medical treatments, helping to do away with paternalism in the doctor-patient relationship. So those are all concepts that really came out of the feminist movement. The main focus of this book is on women in pharmaceuticals, and the main focus of my chapter on the advertising was actually concerns that women are at greater risk of harm from the advertising than men. If you look at the way that it's been targeted to women and also just the risks of harm from prescription drug use and from drug use that's unnecessary. So I think it's one of those situations where if you look, you could look at the use of the language and language like increasing autonomy. And then if you look at the actual advertisements themselves, something very different is going on. I mean, the I Am Julie is an extreme example where it's really building on stereotypical images of women as a sex object. You don't have a face on this woman. You just have a shapely bum in stockings and a garter belt. And the idea that a woman's life somehow will really open up 5 pounds less from where she is now. But if you look more broadly at a lot of the messages in the advertisements, certainly it doesn't meet the criteria, sort of basic criteria for empowerment or autonomy, which is access to information that's unbiased, that's complete, that would help a person to make appropriate treatment decisions or to share in decisions with their physician.
Well, you talk about that in relation to information about birth control.
Yeah.
So we just have, what kind of birth control information do we get if we go to the magazines?
So you get a lot of ads for birth control. Right now, a drug that's been very heavily advertised in the U.S. is a product called Yaz and another alternative called Yasmin. And the company that was, Bayer is a company that's carrying out that advertising. Actually, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration asked it not only to pull the television ads for Yaz, but also to publish corrective advertising because they had used both because the information about the product was very misleading in terms of giving the impression that it's better than other birth control pills, giving the impression that it's something that's useful for any kind of acne. So it's approved for moderate to severe acne. And in the U.S., it's approved for a kind of questionable psychiatric diagnosis, premenstrual dysphoric dysfunction, which actually is not even a standard psychiatric diagnosis, but the way that the FDA defines it is very severe kind of depression-like symptoms that will ebb and wane with the menstrual cycle. The FDA found that the company was just really promoting the drug for regular premenstrual, premenstrual hormonal changes and mood changes that anybody who's normal would have. So, I mean, one of the things it doesn't do is give you an idea of what's the better or worse choice. This would not be a first choice for birth control because.
So we're not talking about information for consumers. You know, we're sometimes told that advertising is just information for consumers, but we're getting one very small slice.
Of course. The aim of advertising is to sell a product. And, you wouldn't expect a Coca-Cola ad to give information to consumers about what the best cold drink might be for them to have on a hot day. You know, they're going to... This is the same kind of techniques. It's the same advertising companies that are advertising these products as well. So you have the same kind of techniques. Actually, there was an interesting analysis that was carried out of a sample of television ads in the U.S. where they looked at what were the emotive techniques that were being used. And you had the condition, the condition. So you often have a sort of story that's like a before and after drug use story in the ads. And with the before period of time, you have the themes that were commonly being portrayed were loss of control over one's life. With the after period, it was things like the drug bringing happiness, like people smiling, and also social approval. Like often a woman, you'd see, say, a woman with her husband or her partner's arm around her in the after period of time with the ad. So things that really have nothing to do with medicine use, that they're a way of selling, kind of giving a person a very positive impression associated with a brand that's very similar to the kind of techniques that are used with branding with a range of products. The difference with a prescription drug is that it's something that can be very severely harmful that can have both harmful and beneficial effects. And
even the best drug, when you need it, can have side effects that are very destructive.
Yeah.
And I guess none of that gets in there.
It doesn't come out in the emotive messages. Even when in the U.S. ads where they actually have to tell the public, by law they have to say something about side effects, you'll see the images are of happy people, laughing and walking through beautiful green fields while they're talking about liver failure, nausea, vomiting, all kinds of awful things that can happen. But I think that's one of the key issues. And, in terms of taking a prescription medicine, if a person is if they're severely ill, it's worth risking those side effects, particularly if the drug is something that's been found to be effective. A lot of the ads say, if you take the ads for antidepressants, for instance, they really will blur the line between normal sadness and a psychiatric condition that might actually benefit from drug use. You know, one of the main things that they've been found to do in terms of the market research literature is to expand the market for specific medicines.
Now, one of the points you make in the book is that normal life events, as you were just saying, are turned into some kind of medical problem.
Yeah, that there's also, and that's one where if you think about, is that really empowering? Is that more choice? So one of the things that's happened is, for instance, because the market for birth control products is very, it's what you'd call a very saturated market. There are lots of different birth control pills. They're all equally effective. So the companies have been looking at ways to sort of, if you like, a bit, I would call them gimmicks, that would help to market specific products. And one of the things that they've done is they've started marketing birth control pills that are used, say, for 3 months at a time, and so a woman doesn't have to have a menstrual period. And so you have the idea, what happens is kind of a side effect of that marketing is the idea that menstruation is something that you need to take a pill to do away with, rather than being something that's kind of a normal, healthy part of being a woman. There's also a sort of a heavy dose of a hype that goes with it, in the sense that these pills that you take, say, something like Seasonal that you take for 3 months at a time, what it does is, so it reduces the number of planned menstrual bleeds, but there's a lot of intermenstrual spotting and bleeding, more than you get with a pill that you take on a monthly cycle. So in fact, the FDA also found the advertising for that drug to be misleading, because women had just as many days of bleeding or spotting
Unpredictable.
Yeah, what's the advantage in that? Yeah.
Who is the book aimed at?
So it's aimed, in part, it's put out by Women's Press, which is part of Canadian Scholars Press. So one of the audiences, or the aim, is for students who are in women's studies or who are in health policy or in the health professions. But it's also aimed at the general public as well, because it's the first book ever that looks at pharmaceutical policy in Canada in terms of what is the specific effect on women and what are the implications for women of what's going on now, and kind of what kind of changes do we need if we want to have a more a pharmaceutical policy that would be leading more to a situation that's consistent with women's equality and with equal access to healthcare services.
Well, congratulations on getting the book out.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Barbara Mintzes. She wrote one of the chapters in a new book called The Push to Prescribe. Barbara Mintzes is with the Therapeutic Initiative at UBC. The Push to Prescribe is about women and the pharmaceutical industry, as Barbara was just saying. It was edited by Anne Roshan Ford and Diane Sable, and it's published by Women's Press, and you can find them at womenspress.ca. And the book's going to launch in Toronto in early October.